This episode of Ticket Volume is brought to you by us, Invigate. Get service operations under control in no time. Get one free month of our software solution by going to try.invigate.com. Ticket Volume is proud to present a senior learning specialist and DevOps ambassador for DevOps, Agile, Project, Program, and IT Service Management at QA LTD, part of the group with Cloud Academy and Circus Street. He's also served as the senior trainer consultant at FGI Training and Consultancy for over 10 years, and he's worked in the Army for over 25 years as well. Welcome to Ticket Volume, news and information for IT professionals. I'm your host, Matt Barron, and each week I get the opportunity to geek out with different leaders and share their insights on service management, technology, business, and this episode is going to be right on par. I hope that you're having a great day and a great week. I also hope that you'll leave a comment or connect with us or share a podcast with someone. And if you find this topic useful and you find this episode entertaining, we are hosting a live discussion on this same topic later this month. Register today at ticketvolume.com. Get involved, get us improving. Now, let's begin. Welcome to Ticket Volume, David Tomlinson.
Hi, Matt. And by the way, I'll start with, I am a geek. I hope I'm amongst friends.
we should have an oath you say at the beginning.
Absolutely. But I self-identify. It's not pejorative for me.
Nice. Well done. Yeah. I don't think it's pejorative to anyone anymore. I hope it's not, because we're all geeks about something. It could be cars. It could be fashion. It could be monocles. Anything. You can be a geek about anything.
Absolutely. And thank you very much for having me, as we say. This has been a passion of mine for some time. I've always liked to characterize myself as being an integrator, and hopefully we won't offend too many people when we prick too many people's little balloons when we actually put some of this stuff together. But this has been something I've been doing now for several decades, and I love it when you see us getting the synergy. I'm using one of the buzzwords already, when you get two things working together. And you add a third, and suddenly it goes to a different place in the stratosphere. And that's, apologies to the flat earthers there when I said stratosphere. Anyway, but it does come, when these things come together, it is a thing of real beauty and something that really great people manage to do.
So you're just getting started on this episode. You can hear already David Tomlinson, a.k.a. Tomo, which I'm going to call you for the rest of the episode.
Yeah, no problem.
I'm going to do my best to keep Tomo focused, because the dude goes. He goes and goes. And when I reached out to you about this podcast episode, what we're really trying to figure out is, I don't think there is a perfect solution for what concepts and ideas and frameworks you should combine, but you had an idea. You had a term for this already, right when I reached out for you for the episode. You called it the great integrator, was it the great integrator? Explain that. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's like the great pretender, but the idea that you can be the great integrator, because fundamentally, it's about conducting the orchestra, not playing the instruments. And it's about bringing that together. It's orchestration is what we're talking about, not jamming sessions. And I think one of the things that we all believe, that we see this new idea and we've discovered the one true way, you know, one framework to bring them all, one ring to bind them, one ring to take them all in the darkness. You know, it's great on Lord of the Rings, but it's not really true, because there's not one great true framework and there's not one great true holy grail that makes this all work. What this is about many, I'm very much as there are many paths to enlightenment. There are many routes up the mountain, and many of them are equally valid. And the reality is that anywhere that makes tomorrow a little better than today is the right direction. And that's quite fundamental. It is incremental. It is small steps. There is no accident why ITIL 4 talks about being iterative and starting where you are, because these are just common. My grandmother could teach this stuff. It's common sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, my grandmother could. It's mostly common sense. But basically, you can see why they become principles. And all good frameworks that are principle-based have tailoring the framework as one of its principles.
Bingo.
Prince 2 has it. We've always had adopt and adapt in ITIL, right the way from the first iteration. So we've always had adapting. What was it? Adapt and overcome. Is that somebody or other from a film? I'm not too sure. But there's always this idea of adapting and overcoming is part of what all good principle-based approaches take. There is always those competing frameworks that go, there is no God but this framework, all hail the God framework, that says you must use the name and you must use the terminology, and without it, if you break one thing, it's all wasteful. That's because they're in competition with the frameworks. It's quite simple.
Yeah.
I once had somebody ask me, why does DSDM, by the way, much hallowed and used in the British industry in the mid-90s, why doesn't it use standard terminologies like Scrum? And you went, because it was written the year before. There's a good reason why it doesn't use standard Scrum terminology. It was written on the other side of the Atlantic the year before. And so there's every good reason why it doesn't use Scrum terminology, because it's equally valid. Now, who cares if it's called a sprint or if it's called an evolutionary time box? The product doesn't care.
No.
And never did.
No.
Because they're both 2 weeks long and they both end up in a retrospective and they both do pretty similar stuff.
Yeah.
Got it?
And if you think about it, you want the same inputs, the same outputs, and the value to be created. Who cares what you call it?
Yeah. And a rose by any other name should smell as sweet, said Shakespeare. and it's absolutely true. Yet we get hung up on it. And I love the fact that I've been burnt as a heretic several times on several forums over the years. And you say, I like to call it this, burn him. And you get these silly questions like, how often do you do the daily stand-up? Which is a common question. Every day.
Yeah.
People go, is that why it's called daily? And you go, it's in the answer. It's there to help you. And many of them use names that seem weird because they're functionally named. The business case is the case we make to the business. They're named after their function. If you say it backwards, it normally explains itself. But we pick names and go, that's the one true name for it. It is locally. And if you're recruiting people, it makes sense to use the standard name because people understand it. But in the real world, you know, outside of the confines of our examinations, our certifications, and I know there's a healthy group of skeptics out there that go, certifications are evil and they're invented by employers to punish us. But in reality, most of the people I see, and I help people take certifications every week, most people I see taking them quite like them and they hang them on the wall. And in actual fact, even if employers didn't ask for them, as geeks would still get them, because secretly, and this is a secret, let me tell you a little bit, this is a secret, we actually quite like them because we like hanging things on the wall and we like pointing at things and we like digital badges. It's something, it's human nature, right? But there is this idea that in the examination, it makes sense. But outside of that, does it really matter? And the answer, it probably doesn't. There was a lovely piece of research by a guy called Patrick Mayfield who looked at what made projects successful, what made projects and programs successful. Instead of asking, why did they go wrong, which is what most people ask, he said, what made them successful?
Yeah.
And he personality typed all of the highly successful, highly regarded program managers, expecting there was going to be some control freak gene.
Yeah.
Discover some thing that they did that nobody else did. And what he actually discovered is they were all people.
Yeah.
That actually had nothing to do with their technical ability or the thing. And in actual fact, how good they were at communicating was actually four times more likely to make the project successful than the actual products. In other words, a bad product well presented was better thought of than a brilliant product badly handled.
Yes.
And the secret sauce was actually engagement. The secret sauce, if there was one, was actually the ability to relate what we do to people and to get the people to understand the value. And then it seems to be successful because it's delivering the thing that's valuable to them.
Oh, that's such a good point, Tomo. Project managers and program managers are leaders. They are functional leaders, not role leaders. They're not assigned executive titles and manager titles. But without a great program manager, project manager, you don't get anywhere. No one's talking. No one's working together.
And one of the things that I certainly told somebody who hired me, they said, we're looking to you as a technical project manager to give me technical advice. I said, if you want technical advice from me, boy, did you hire the wrong techies.
Yeah.
I'm the last person you should be asking technical advice for. We've got perfectly good techies who know how that works. We just need to learn how to get them to speak to them. And then we don't have the problem anymore. But there's this sort of inbuilt idea that hierarchy brings safety. And if there's one thing the DevOps movement has shown us, that is not true.
Yes.
Every single exploit, every single crash, every single cyber disaster that you and I have ever seen went through CAB. It all got approved. And it all ended really badly. But it all got signed off. So it doesn't really work. And it has never really worked, but it made us all feel a bit safer. So it was a bit like a nightlight. We got, it just gave us a bit more confidence, but it didn't really help. The reality is getting really great people who know their stuff to talk to other great people who know their stuff in a language they can both understand. If your framework is doing that, then we're 2/3 the way to the party.
Exactly.
And if you want to call it something else or dress it up as something else, it doesn't really matter. And at this point, you go, if that's all it is, why are they all so popular? We all like to believe in a talisman. We all like to believe that we've discovered the route to the Holy Grail. And we all like to believe that this is the one true way. And if I just do it like this, and it's a form of superstition, really, if we think about it. The reality, no, isn't. The reality is actually, if you say what's common between all of these, and this is what you need to look at, the common thread, they all talk about value. Okay, project managers call them benefits. We all like to call that value, just enumeration of value. We all like to call them value. Service managers call it value. In fact, in Title 4, we call it co-creative value, which is probably right. It's a common thread. We all like to think this good stuff flows from this, and we all like to think we know what it is. There's always communication. There's always engagement, whether we like to call them stakeholder engagement or what we want to call it. There is always this idea of knowing who is interested in your value and speaking to them in a way that makes sense. And the closer you engage that, and then there's always a product. There's always a thing. And this thing has somebody who uses it. I know we like in the IT business to call them users. By the way, only drug dealers and us call them users. Nobody else does, right? But we all like to think that there's these people over here. And then there's these people over here who make stuff. And funnily enough, if you can bring those two groups together in a way, in a forum, in a cycle that makes sense, then you're off to the races, because if the people making it and the people using it are actually having a dialogue, then you're bound to make what people actually need as opposed to what people ask for. And if there's one thread that runs through all of this integration, is the more we abstract ourselves from that very simple idea, the more we put modeling languages and specification documents and all of that in the way, we get away from something in a meaningful time frame, which is what people actually need. So anything that creates that DevOps second way feedback, anything that stops us then for experimenting with people who know their business, then that means that development's going to be slow, it's going to be awkward, and it's going to be very expensive.
Yeah.
Whereas everything else is cheaper because it's disposable.
Yeah.
Yeah, so absolutely. If that's the way we're moving as a body, as all of those bodies out there, and this isn't new. This started with Tai Chi Ono and the new product game in the mid-80s. I love telling people on Agile courses that what I'm teaching them is 40 years old.
Yeah.
Because they think it arrived yesterday. But in reality... But we don't. We fake it. We all went to the mountain, and I think it was called Snowbird, and we all worshipped when the four values came down the mountain with the 17 apostles gathered round, and they chiselled in stone, and they went off to think of these 12 principles. But it was all nonsense, because the people signing it had already written Scrum, and one of the chaps was a DSM practitioner. These things already existed and had done for about 10 or 12 years before. None of that is true, but the fact is that plays well on courses, that plays well to people, and they like that reassurance. But in reality, it goes back further than that, and I think this is all part of the post-war drift that we've seen. So this goes back 70-odd years, when we've seen a lot of the efficiencies that came out of the Second World War and the manufacturing of the Second World War. then meant that one of my own corps, Royal Signals Officer, made the Volkswagen. He's the guy that put Volkswagen back on its feet after the war. And these are just common sense and practical, but that's that longshore drift, as I like to call it. This idea of the pebble moves at the beach. It's that longshore drift that we've been in now for 70, 80 years, that you and I are just pebbles on that beach as we get washed along, but inexorably moving up the beach. With each passing tide, you and I move up the beach and we get a little bit better today than we were yesterday, and we're in that improvement. And I think that's why whether you're using brand X or brand Y doesn't really matter. And using brand X or brand Y and not thinking of these basic things, doing robotic agile doesn't work. Doing robotic service management, where you have cab every week, but you don't actually use your brain, where you just go through the motions, where everything gets a ticket, but nobody uses their common sense. Mm-hmm. And you end up then with these bizarre things like, I know somebody had just installed Terraform, but they still had to wait till Friday for the cab to tell them they could press a button that allowed it to come up in 6 minutes. Why? The process says, all hail the process. Because we've fallen in love with the process and forgotten what it was for.
Yeah, we play these games. So we get used to playing the games and forgetting why we're playing the games.
And it's the gamification of business that makes it ritualistic. But the reality is there is no reason to do lots of this stuff, and you have every right to try it, experiment. We talk about the three ways of the Phoenix Project. We talk about the three ways. The third one is experimentation. Suck it and see. If it doesn't work, discard it. We are grown-ups. We have every right to make those decisions. We are not children. And I remember doing an agile service management course, a great course. I really enjoyed doing it for the Devils Institute, and I was doing it. And then somebody says, but hang on, isn't this continuous improvement done properly? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've nailed it. The whole agile movement is just what we used to call continuous improvement, just done properly. And fine. I actually had one of the guys who wrote the original continual service improvement book in the room at the time. He's one of our old instructors, and he beamed ear to ear when he heard that. But fundamentally, yes. So I said to a friend of mine, how come we never see, nobody does CSI properly, nobody does continuous improvement properly? Of course not. I said, we're ITIL consultants. Everybody we see can't do it.
Yeah.
Because the people who are doing it don't use ITIL consultants.
Yeah.
Because they don't have any need to.
Yeah.
It's like the guy who eats the apple every day doesn't go to the doctor. He doesn't need to. The doctor just thinks the whole world doesn't eat fruit. Why? Because the healthy people don't come and see him.
Yeah.
And it's a quite reasonable thing when you realize what we've actually got is survivor bias, or the opposite. We've got we only see sick people. It's understanding that those people who can apply continuous improvement principles clearly, that have a way of doing it, that use their common sense, that pragmatism that we build everything off, doesn't have half of these problems. And we can, it's not picking and choosing. We've got to be careful to use that English phrase, we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We don't just pick something from a framework and then throw away the reason. So you have to understand it. I think that's what the training is there for, Matt, is you cannot do this until you fully understand it.
Yes.
Once you fully understand how it works and what the mechanisms are for, then we can play a little bit more fast and loose, because we can then talk about how we will apply it. But fundamentally, you've got to understand it first, which is what the education is there for. Rather than going, I'm going to paint by numbers because I've got my canvas and I'm just going to fill the numbers in.
Yeah.
And how come I don't get what he got? But well, no, because you've got the paint by numbers version of Van Gogh's daisies. He's Van Gogh.
Yeah.
he's got the talent. All you've done is just paint by the numbers. What we need to say is, how do we develop our talent? How do we ensure that it works for us? I love the fact that Ranger School has got this wonderful monument. They've got a gravestone by the cookhouse that says, here's a graduate of this institution. He did this following the directing staff solution. In other words, you can't just paint by numbers and expect it to work.
Right.
That will lead to some inevitable failures. What we need to do is understand it and apply it, and then we can actively use it. So when it comes to integrating these together, yes, There are some very sign SMEs, very good. ITIL, I haven't done it for years, they're very good. Agile Service Management, very good, you know. But really, what it's asking us to do is to apply any of these, SIAM, whatever, apply them logically. Apply them illogically, and they won't work for you. Because you need to use that stakeholder engagement and say, what is important to my stakeholders? What is important, therefore, to me and us? Because it's a team game. That's the other thing I'd like to bring out, Matt, is we can be as brilliant as we like, but it's a team game.
Yeah.
Nothing of what that we do on our own. Yeah. By definition, a service is a collection of people. And when we forget that, when we think it's a process or it's a mechanism, I love when you meet these people who are completely mechanistic, you know, McGregor's theory, X theory, Y types. I remember once, what was it? Margaret's not work isn't as good as it was. Yeah, she's looking after her mum's dying. It's really sad. Yes, he said, but what's wrong with Margaret? And you think, spot the psychopath in the room, please. It's very easy to spot. But they understand that the mechanism becomes more important to them than the people. And that's very dangerous, because fundamentally it works when good people apply it with common sense. Because let's be honest, Matt, you know, you are not trying to bring down your organization from the inside.
No,
I'm not trying to bring down QA from the inside. I'm not a sleeper agent. That's a, you know, it makes a great movie, but it's not the truth, right?
Yeah.
You and I are trying to get to 4:30 every day in one piece, right? That's what everybody's trying to do, and they hope can get there without too much bother and most things working. That's a quite reasonable thing to do. As a result, neither you nor I need to be berated about trying harder. We need a way of working together that means that when we do screw up, we at least put it right next time. And once you realize that, then the leader has to walk the walk as well as talk the talk. The leader has to absorb the on high pressure. They have to hear you getting told off, and then you have to walk in and go, okay, guys, I took that for the team. Let's crack on. They need to see that happen because that's how you build up your store as a leader. And that's what being a true technical leader is all about, is absorbing that pressure that you get from the organization. So they don't have to. So they're free to do their jobs. And it's not about letting them off. It's about recognizing that that's not what they signed up for. This isn't what they do. And taking it for the team is part of what a leader does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how leadership is transactional. I give trust to you, you give trust to me. I give praise to you, you think I'm an okay guy. That's how it works, right? Every con man knows, I'll let you hold my cheap watch and you'll trust me to take your truck, yeah?
Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah. The fact I trust you with something that you think I think is valuable. And it's the same here. We trust each other with our emotions because everything we do is built with passion. And by the way, if it isn't, you've got bigger problems that's going to be solved by some mechanism, process.
No framework will give you that kind of passion.
No framework will give you the heart and the passion. And too often we look at the frameworks, we look at the diagrams, and it speaks to our heads, and we leave out the heart, the bit that goes along with it, that even geeks, the analytical ones, have a heart. It doesn't matter if you're on the spectrum. We all have a heart. And you have to appeal to it. Sometimes is the correct way to do it, and there's the right way to do it. And the right way to do it, it just feels right. Right. And I think that's something that we need to appreciate, because we need to have people, and I love Turn the Ship Around. David L. Marquette's book is a great book. I love his videos. But he's right. You have to do it like the CEO sat on your shoulder. But he doesn't have to be. It's as if he's there, because you wouldn't do it as if he wasn't there. Because you have that passion that says, I want to do my best. And it's as if the boss is in the room. And the boss doesn't have to be in the room, but it's as if he is or she is.
Yeah.
And that's fundamental to how trust works. And have I screwed up? Yeah, of course I have, Matt. You can't be in this business for more than 5 minutes. We've all got tails. Mm-hmm. I like to have these psychologically safe moments on my courses where I ask people, who screwed up? And it's really great to hear some of them, and they're horrendous. I once deleted the entire Root database for a 4,000 person firm. And they share them, and you go, wow. But we've all done it.
Yeah.
And I think this is where the DevOps movement particularly is very good. Every single person who comes through the operation side of life knows what it feels like to have something broken and everybody look at them, and you haven't got a clue. Everyone in operations had that moment. We've all had that moment when everyone goes, so, Matt, what are we doing? And
yeah.
Matt looks back and goes, well, I haven't got a clue. You have to say something. I have no idea. Let's get to work on this and see what happens, right?
Yeah.
Everybody in the service management operations world has been there, and we all know what that feels like. As a result, we don't tend to beat each other up very much because we go, you know what? We've all been there. I feel your pain. We've all got that. We were there, man. It's a connection. And because of that, we tend to be quite nice to each other. Whereas, of course, for those people who've only ever thrown software over a fence, people who've only ever got story points and then chucked it, they could be quite mean because they've never had to live with the consequences. So they've never been in that position where... So as a result, those forums can be really quite nasty because nobody lives with the consequence. But the thing is, we in service management live with the ticket. We live with the consequences of our decisions. You and I both know that one of the best things I ever did was a guy called Barry, no longer with us, Barry Pearson. He was one of my guys, worked for me. And I heard him saying, people in the service desk didn't get that. I said, tomorrow, do a shift on the service desk. What? So then do a shift on the service desk. So he came back at lunchtime, tail between his legs. It was horrible. I said, somebody rang up. He said, okay, there was a real service desk analyst with him if they got stuck.
Yeah.
He said, a woman rang up. He says, and halfway through, I realized the thing she was having a problem with was something I'd badly written, something I'd done. And I went, yeah. He says, don't worry. I said, we'll add it to the backlog. So you don't understand, boss. I've come from my desk. It's done. I've corrected it. I've fixed it already. I couldn't bear it for a minute longer. But it was very sobering when he realized the consequences of his actions. And this is what things like SRE at Google and things like DevOps working together is all trying to do, is when we don't get closer to our consequences, we find it easier to integrate these things. Whether that's tool sets, whether that's mechanisms. Yes, there'll still be stuff managed as projects. Projects won't die. We might do fewer of them, but they won't die. We might do it in a more agile way. But there'll still be some things that need to be end-to-end. Some things just are. Things are going to be continuous, and that's fine. But whether you call it safe, or whether you call it dad, or whether you call it, I don't know what you call it, doesn't really matter. And if you want to call it a tribe or an agile release train, who cares? Certainly not me, but what it does mean is you work together, and you work together in a long-lived team, and you work together with people you trust. I do swarming, and people go, oh, radical. And I go, don't be silly. Every single one of us has a black book in our back pocket of people we ring when the bad times come.
Yeah.
You've got one, I've got one, we've all got one.
Yeah.
Every single one of us who works in operations has a little black book that we use when the escalation system's not working and this really has got to be fixed. And we bring out a little black book and we just ring people who know. And all swarming is just that, done first instead of last. Nothing more, nothing less. So a lot of these things that we dress up aren't really that dressed up. The reality is we do them anyway. It's just we're giving people permission. I dealt with a company once and they said, yeah, we use Prince 2, but... we don't do this. And we use Prince 2, but we don't do that. We do Prince, we don't, I call it Prince 2, but.
Yeah.
When I said to them, that is Prince 2. And said, what do you mean? I said, the whole point is tailoring. The seventh principle is tailoring. Mm-hmm. Doing this, but not that, is exactly how you're supposed to do it. It's like meatloaf. You'll do anything to love, but you're not going to do that. That's fine. And it is, and that is what you're supposed to do. It isn't. You're not doing it wrong. Yeah, so light is idle. It always was. It never was something strange. It's what it always was. It's just good idle. It's just enough idle, which is what it should be anyway. Yet people still made out it was and tried to turn it into something that it wasn't to sell it to people who could buy it again. But in reality, all idle should be light. It should only be as heavyweight as it needs to be. It's like your tooling. Everyone can use a tool, and a tool will be better than not a tool. But how much of a tool you need and how in depth you want to go into it and how many things you want to integrate into it. That's a journey map. That you're a toolsmith, and that's the background. But there are 5 people companies out there that can use your tool with a light touch, and there are 5,000 people companies who have to use it with a very heavy touch.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, have to touch almost all of it. That doesn't invalidate the use of a tool. It doesn't make it any less or more useful. And a fool with a tool is still a fool. They can just do more damage, as we used to say. But fundamentally, you know, it's not about the quality of the tool. It's about the quality of how it's used.
Yes.
And that's down to the human decisions that we make. So invest in humans. You know, the reason why I'm involved with the DevOps Institute is because of the human side of DevOps, because I realize it's the human side that makes the difference. Because when our AI overlords, I've got to be nice to them, they'll pay my pension. But when the AI overlords come up, you know, in reality, they're not going to replace people. Because in the end, it's people who have got to bring that together. AI is never going to be the day-to-day decision-making tool that's going to save your company, your organization. That's never going to be true. It might take away a lot of the drudgery, so we don't have to do that boring and I have to say, the stuff we're not very good at. And it's about playing to the strengths of the human beings. And the human being is judgment, communication, empathy, heart. That's what we're good at. And that raises design and drawing into art. And that's what we bring to it, is the paint by numbers approach. We need to turn that into art. And to do that, we need to bring a bit of us. Because there has been a bit of me in every computer system I've ever designed, and in every system I've ever set up, there's been a bit of me in it. And along with everyone else who was there, there is a bit of us in every part of that. Because there has to be. Without that, it's cold. And it doesn't work. And it is something a very wise man said to me is, whatever people are resisting now, the thing they're resisting about was once imposed upon them by the last guy. Right? Mm. So whatever it is they're defending, they once vociferously defended against to the version before. And they will defend what eventually they'll adopt what you give them, and they will defend that one to the next person who's trying to change it. It's that inevitable idea that this is the way we've always done it, and why should we change? And it's that concept which means that resistance to change isn't really resistance to change. It's just something that needs a bit more time. Because in reality, everybody comes round in time. And yet we are so impatient sometimes to see results. Or we've made the mistake of promising somebody there's going to be a result in X weeks, Y months or whatever. Because that sounded good at the time. But my experience has always been when people go, how difficult can it be? And it's often much more than you think. How long is it going to take? And a lot longer than you thought it was.
Oh,
but that's inevitable, because as knowledge grows, as detail grows, as knowledge grows, our understanding grows, then our needs will change. And that's due to dialogue. So all of our frameworks, and I've mentioned a few, whether it's SAFORB, whether it's ITIL or VeriSign SM or SIAM, it doesn't really matter. All of these frameworks need to be adopted and adapted appropriately to how we want to work. None of them are wrong. None of them are inherently better than the other than they might be better for you right now.
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily. Sometimes it's better to have a poor system well implemented than a brilliant system badly implemented. So sometimes it's fine to be going to carry on with what you've got for the time being. And recognizing that these things are only stepping stones. They're only a stepping stone to where you're going to be soon. And looking back, there was a stone behind that you left behind. And that's okay, no matter how much we loved it.
Yes.
How much investment we had in it, we have to let it go. And I apologize to all the parents out there who've now got that tune in their head. I do apologize. But you've got to learn to let go. And so this is Barry O'Reilly and this consciously unlearning thing. You have to learn to let old structures go and new structures come in order to move everything forward. And it hurts. And we have to recognize that in ourselves as well. Because one of the most insidious cognitive bias you can have, Matt, is the one that says, I'm too smart to have a cognitive bias, which is the most insidious of all of the cognitive biases, which is they don't apply to me. Of course they do.
Right, yes, they do. Yeah,
we're human, of course they do. And it hurts too. And we hang on to it. We like to feel that we've got something that, you know, of us that we don't want to let go of. And that's natural and normal and to be expected because we're human. And we should give everybody a bit of patience, a bit of time, and a bit of respect, because they're not being awkward. They're not being difficult. It's just part of that thing that being human is all about. Now, you can train people, we did it in the military, to do this faster. You can get people used to chaos. In fact, in the military, they deliberately create chaos and throw you into it in order to make you good at it. But fundamentally, you can accelerate the process, but the process is still there. You still have to be able to process it. You can just, at the end of the day, history is written by chaos, not by conspiracy theories or by some kind of magic system. All of these try to tame chaos to a certain extent, but life is inherently chaotic with lots of variation that you and I cannot predict. Therefore, it's a tool, but what it's not is a talisman. If I do everything it says in this Prince 2 manual or this Agile PM manual, does it mean that all the uncertainty goes away? Of course not.
No.
I've been on risk management training and I've got a matrix and I've got a Monte Carlo simulator. Good for you.
Yeah.
Does it make the uncertainty go away?
No.
No. it helps us understand it a bit better. It puts some numbers on it. Let's make some better quality decisions. One of the best pieces of feedback I ever got from retrospective was Tomlinson. I don't know why we bother with all this risk management stuff. You went on and on about it. Nothing went wrong. What a waste of time. And you go, yeah, the reason why nothing went wrong is because we went on about it.
Yes.
So that was its value. But to him, you went, well, what was the point? 90% of what you worry about never happens, which happens to be true. But it doesn't happen because we worried about it and we made plans and we sorted it out. And it's that recognizing that a mechanism will help, but it won't prevent. It's not an iron suit. It's not going to stop you getting hurt. All it's going to do is reduce some of the odds and maybe help you fight back better. But what it's not going to do is stop the pain. That's not true. And if you think that we've spent all this money on training everybody in Brand X and Brand X will save us, no, not really. What it might do, it'll help.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, no, because you and I both know that there are tickets that are going to turn up that nobody saw coming.
Bingo.
Because that's the nature of what we do. What we do is inherently, IT systems are inherently complex that go wrong in novel and new ways that you and I never thought of. And nobody ever thought of. It's the nature of the beast. People say, are you shocked when an outage happens? And I went, no, I'm shocked it works as much as it does.
That's so legitimate.
When you consider just how many moving parts there are in most IT systems and most things that have to be right and everything's got to be right, and you've got to remember the password as well, by the way, and
it's
all
a
this
miracle.
Stuff stacks up and all of this has got to be 100% correct for that button to work, I'm gobsmacked it works on a reasonably frequently. When you consider the sheer amount of variability that we see. And so we shouldn't suggest that one true way is going to save us. That's just catastrophic thinking.
Yeah.
What we should say is we need a range of tools, because if we don't have an idea of what to do when the bad time comes, we're going to be caught out. If we don't have a sensible way of introducing new stuff, it'll be chaos. If we don't have some of the tooling pipelines and service desk tools that allows us to manage our own information, it's not going to work. It's fundamental that we need these things. Whether we need Brand X or Brand Y, it's great and it exercises salespeople, and God love them, we all love a good salesperson. That's not the point. The point is we need to have some of these tools in our armory. We talk about a golf club, but you've got to have the right golf club for the right moment. Okay, mine is mostly the sand wedge, but that's for obvious reasons, Matt. I spend a lot of time in bunkers. But the reality is, if you want to drive a ball, we want a driver. If you want to putt, we need a putter. We have to have the right club for the task. And that's what we're looking to gain as professionals, is the understanding and access to a range of these mechanisms and tools so that you and I can reach down inside of ourselves, go and grab the thing that we need when we need it. And we can preempt the stuff that we do need to do as we go along. And we've got then those sensible defaults and those sensible reactions so that when the bad times do come, which is what they pay us for, by the way, they don't really pay us to watch everything work brilliantly, but which is we like going, today, nothing happened. Oh, wonderful. And as much as everyone likes, that's not what they're paying us for, right? They pay us for those times when it's all gone horribly wrong and everyone's looking at Matt going, what do we know, Matt?
Yeah.
That's what they pay you for. It's for you in that moment to say something halfway coherent that moves us in the right direction, because that's what they pay you for. We're getting paid for that. We're not getting paid for the other stuff. That is fundamental, that as long as we've got what we need when those bad times come, when we feel confident in it, that's what we need to have. I always remember watching a documentary program where somebody said, oh, yes, these ancient temples had to be built by aliens because look at the way the stones fit so closely together. And at the time, I was working in a shop that sold fireplaces in the days when carved stone fireplaces were a thing. Hey, it was the 70s, don't judge, right?
Yeah.
And I was working exactly the job. And I said to one of the stonemasons, I said, just how hard is it to make two stones fit together like that? He said, dead easy. You just take two stones that didn't fit together. He covered them in chalk. He rubbed them together. Where they rubbed off, he hit them with a hammer. And then he repeated. And he did that 20 or 30 times. And the two fit perfectly together. I went, so why didn't the guy on the telly know? He said, oh, he's some professor. Has no idea, does he? And what that taught me is sometimes the people on the tools who actually do this thing every day have some kind of body of insight that some of the experts don't have. And that actually the way to find something out is to go to the people who actually do this for a living and ask them. And we don't do enough of that, Matt. Mm-hmm. We just really don't. I ask people on my courses to send me the name of the world's expert at their job. And, you know, your actual job, not just your generic job, but your actual job. Who's the world's expert? And of course, after an embarrassed moment, they go, me. Or a wise person goes, my wife. Anyway, that's fine. But they say, me. So why don't they ask you about it? If you're the world's experts at this, because you do it for a living and you're a serious human being, you're a proper person, as they say in Sheffield, a proper mester. But anyway, a mester, by the way, means a master craftsman. They call them little mesters. But anyway, if you know what you're doing, why wouldn't you know? And that's fundamentally, we go back to people like Daniel Pink and autonomy, mastery and purpose, the things that really motivate people. We want to be masters of what we do. We want to feel that what we're doing is useful. We want to feel that we're being left alone to get on with it. It's very simple requirements we have. And a good framework allows that to happen. A good framework empowers people. A good framework empowers people to talk to each other. And a good framework provides that. And that's what all the really great ones, when really well implemented, do, because it allows good people to do great work. What you can't do with all the framework in the world is get demotivated people to do any work at all.
Yeah, nothing's going to fix that.
Nothing's going to. Yeah, yeah. If that's your problem, no framework in the world, no course you can go on is going to help you with that one. No tool you buy off the internet is going to help you with that, right?
Yeah.
Fundamentally, that's something you've got to sort out, which is a human problem. But so easily, I can talk to people and we say, oh, yes, so we've just had to do all that SQL training and we're about to go off and do all this technical training and, oh, yeah, it's going to be great. And then you go, what you really need now is you really need an afternoon on facilitation. If you just had an afternoon on workshop facilitation, you'd get the best out of all of these tools. How much that cost? How much money are you trying to waste on that?
Yeah.
Just a little bit of human training. Just to be able to make use of it. And they go, we're not wasting money on that. And the amazing thing is that this kind of training is incredibly cheap. It doesn't cost a lot in comparison with some technical training. Yet it gets the best out of it. Some organizations, large organizations, their HR department actually do this training for free. So it's in their standard HR offering. And you say to the IT department, why don't you send some of your people on this kind of collaborative training? And they go, oh, I ain't got time for that.
Yeah, no time.
How much time are you wasting? It empowers us to use our soft skills. I hate calling them that, but that's what
they're power skills.
Yeah, but it empowers us to use those skills. A good framework gives us the thing to hang our coat on to be able to do that. A poor one tells us we're not allowed to. Poor one, training is something you have as a gift if you've been good.
Yeah.
What's this, The Shining? You know, it's not, you're in a horror movie.
Yeah.
If the phone rings, it's the killer. It's an inside extension. It's a horror movie, right? What you're in is a horror movie. You're locked up with your psychopathic killer. That's not going to help. And yet, we do tend to believe that it is. So my thing is, start where you are, common good sense. Look at what we do now. Look at the good stuff. Look at the things we're not doing well. Look at the deltas. Find out what will help. Now, it may well be a complete overhaul or a new system might be for you. Then again, it might not. But sadly, there's a tendency to be like the child chasing the balloon down the street. We're always chasing the latest sexy thing that's just come out. I used to call them 1-2 projects. I've been to insert name of competitor here, and they've got one of these, and we want 1-2.
Yeah.
We call them 1-2 projects. But no, it works for them. It doesn't necessarily mean it works for us. Be sensible about it and go, what honestly works well for us right now? What are we really good at?
Yes.
And what are we really struggling with? And then go and have a look to see what best matches our needs, and then build out from there. And what you'll find when you do that, good old trading needs analysis, it's not like we don't know how to do it. IT departments are awash with business analysts that know perfectly well how to do this. It's just we turn them on other people. We never use them for ourselves, which is bizarre.
Yes.
Because they all know how to do this. Is you look at yourself and go, okay, what is it we need to do, and where are our gaps? Where do we get a tool that suits our gaps? Where do we get an integrated mechanism that suits our gap? Then have a look at strengthening that gap.
Yes.
And then that'll reveal where the next one is. And if this sounds like good old-fashioned lean, yes, it's just good old-fashioned Tai Chi Ono style. Mary and Tom Poppendieck, Lean IT. This is just good old-fashioned lean.
Yes.
And yet, it's just plan, do, check, act. You have to build in quality to your systems, build in quality to your mechanisms, build in quality to your tooling. You cannot inspect your way to quality. You cannot bolt quality on, and quality is not a topping. Sprinkle it on at the end and hope. That's not a thing. That's never worked. It's not a sprinkles. It's a main ingredient. And you have to bake it in. I'm afraid you have to knead it in, like with the dough. You've got to knock it up, as we say. That is the proper term, by the way. You have to knead it in, because it has to be in there so it can rise. And if we want to rise, we have to knead the air in. And that means we need to put that time in to understanding the mechanism that we're going to have. And when people say we're going to transition from ITIL 3 to ITIL 4, you actually look at most of all the things you don't need to change. The way you think about it does. That certainly changes. Your attitudes change, and the way you approach it changes. And the principles help you to maybe discard some things you don't need to do anymore and bring some stuff in that you probably do need to do.
Yes.
But do you need to throw it all away? No, that's not a requirement. But it is that fundamental. We've moved it on. We've moved it forward in this brave new world where people are now dealing with thousands of changes a day, when we used to do one change a month in those old days. No, we now live in a different world where that isn't going to apply anymore. And as much as we sit, and the story is in England of King Canute, who tried to make the sea go back. This is a story of a king who said, I'm going to go and make the sea, I command the sea to go back. And he put his throne on the seashore. And of course, he got his feet wet when the tide came in. And the point he was making to his nobles was, stop asking me. I'm the king, but I'm not all powerful. The tide comes in on me too. He was making a very sensible philosophical point, which is I'm a king, but there are limits to my powers. And just like the triumphant general in Rome, a slave has to stand on your chariot, whispering in your ear, you are still mortal. We need that for people. We need managers to realize that we're not all seeing, all dancing, all omnipotent and powerful. What we are just disciples on the road, getting as dusty as everybody else and trying our very best to try and stay ahead of the crowd. But fundamentally, it's that little bit. Somebody said to me, what is the greatest quality that a service manager needs? And everyone thought it was going to be something ability or knowledge or skill. And I said humility.
Yeah.
And they went, what? I said, fundamentally, you've got to believe tomorrow could be slightly better than today. But to do that, you have to admit that you didn't get it as right today as you could have.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes humility. If you think, wow, it was a really great day today. This is the best day it ever was. And if you lay there at night chuckling about how fantastic you are, you really need to see somebody, Matt. It's not good for you. It's not mentally healthy. Because fundamentally, that isn't the way that you're supposed to think. You're supposed to think today was good, but tomorrow could be better. And there's that fundamental humility, that belief that says, what I did today was good, but tomorrow could be a little bit better, is the heart of really good progressive frameworks. Because all of them see continuous improvement. All of them see getting better at what you do. Stephen Covey's, what was it? Sharpening the saw. Habits of highly effective people, yeah? That sharpening of the saw, that getting that little bit better, always a little further, Pilgrim. Always that little bit further to that snow-filled peak or that shiny sea. There's always that little bit more to see. And that comes from a sense of humility, that we haven't seen it all, that we don't know it all, and there's room for improvement. And I think that's really where this integration thing comes from.
Yes.
You understand that none of these are perfect. All things are imperfect. You have to apply them logically and with an understanding of who you are as an organization, where you and your heart is, where your morale is, and where you could be, and make a realistic step of where that next step could be, no matter how small. Then get your team there and then show them that old board. You said we did.
So yeah.
It's a hackneyed board. But actually, I've always used them. Everywhere I've ever been the boss, I've always put one up. I've always used them. You lot pointed this out on the last retrospective. And look, we've done something about it.
And yeah.
It doesn't matter how small the thing was.
No.
Because that makes people go, we've made a difference, even if it's only a small one.
We're moving the needle. It gives hope.
And we are that human being who needs that. It feeds that inner human. And that goes across all cultures. That goes across all nations, languages. We all have that need as human beings to feel that what we've done has been purposeful, that what we've done has made a difference. We all have that feeling. Otherwise, we wouldn't come to work every day, because what would be the point? I'm very fortunate. I meet some great students. I meet some great people. But I hope at the end of our interaction, I leave them in a slightly better place than they started. That's got to be my hope.
Mm.
Because if you didn't do that, you'd be some kind of monster to come to work if you didn't believe that. Nobody does. And it doesn't matter what job we do. It's like the old Lyndon B. Johnson thing when he opened the Kennedy Space Center and he sees a janitor there with a brush and a dustpan. And he says, what do you do, son? It's quite obvious what he does. What do you do, son, says the president. And he says, I'm sending a man to the moon, Mr. President. I'm just the janitor, but I have a pretty good idea what we do around here. And I'm not saying every place you work has that same sense.
No.
I think all the best places I've worked has fundamentally understood that. And I think that's probably true of the real places I've loved to work. Everybody around me has had that sense of purpose, of common feeling. And I've managed teams which had service personnel, civil servants, public servants, contractors, day contractors, all mixed in together. And after a few weeks, you couldn't tell who was who. It didn't really matter anymore because they were all working for each other, not I'm a contractor, I don't do that, or I don't do that because I don't get paid overtime. People just help each other out because that's what people fundamentally do.
Yeah.
And so your frameworks that you look at have got to really get out of the way of people and let people work together. And when you do that, does it really matter? No. So I'm happy. My colleagues lead SAFE courses. I'm happy to talk about SAFE. I'll tell you how this works with this. I'm perfectly happy if somebody goes, no, I use less of fear. I'm perfectly happy when somebody comes to me and says, no, we don't use this tool. We use that one instead. Great. So what? If it works for you, that's absolutely fine. For most of my career, my Kanban board had real record cards on real cork boards with real pins, and it worked perfectly well. For most of my career, I wasn't using Jira. For most of my career, I was doing it the old-fashioned way. I stuck pins in boards, and it was just, that's what we did. It worked perfectly well for what it was. But you see my point, the mechanism doesn't really matter. It's like the old joke, how many psychoanalysts does it take to change a light bulb? It doesn't matter, Matt, as long as the light bulb wants to change. Now,
it's
fundamental. If we haven't got the motivation right, none of the other stuff works. All the other stuff around it, it's just icing on a non-existent.
You gotta want it. You gotta want it.
You've got it. And those people who find that, those people who can find that thing that gives a mechanism that allows people to flower, allows people to grow, allows people to do their best work, that has got to be the route to improvement, because they're the ones who are going to feed back. So fundamentally, I don't believe that one framework is ever better than another. Fundamentally not true. If somebody says that to me, I go, you've really not understood it. You know, how to show you don't understand DevOps in two easy lessons, describe it as a framework. Okay, fair enough. What you're doing just fundamentally showing you don't understand it, which is fine. By the way, that came from one of the big four consultancies. How to show you don't really understand this thing. You're thinking, you guys clearly don't get this. Yeah. But fundamentally, we don't. We need to understand that it's that bringing of people together, that making of people to give them a way forward, that is what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And if along the way a few egos have to fall out,
might be a good thing.
I had mine taken out years ago, and I recommend an egoectomy to anybody. It saves a lot of trouble. And the military had it took out for me years ago, and I feel much better for it, to be honest.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, that has always been the problem, that, you know, we've set something up, we put a lot of time, money and effort into it. We don't want to let it go. Sometimes I'm asking people not to move a framework forward. I'm asking people to put their children and throw them out of a lifeboat. Mm. That's the conversation we're having with people. That's their level of emotional investment. And we need, as managers, to be cognizant of that, because that's what we're really managing.
Yeah.
We're really managing their emotions. We're managing their inputs. We're managing their passions. And we're managing as much as we're managing.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, it goes up as well as down. And we need to understand that the people who employ us, the people from upstairs and sideways, they have an investment in this. Yeah. And it comes from many years sometimes. And you've got to understand where that comes from and manage that expectation accordingly. And understand they're not necessarily, they might be bad people, but they're not necessarily bad people to think that. It's just the nature of where they're coming from. And the reality is that as a good manager, if a service manager worth their salt, you are the sponge that holds that together. You're the one who takes that upwards pressure and downwards pressure, and you are the stress relief toy in the sandwich that makes this thing happen. But that is our job. But what comes out of it can be truly beautiful. I can count on the fingers of one hand the people who didn't step up, who, when the time came, crumbled. Hundreds of people, when the time came, stepped up and did their job and did, you know, unbelievably good stuff. And you go and you think that the amount of people I saw crumble, very few. The vast majority took it at full flood and did it beautifully and did it wonderfully. And I've been proud to work with them, because that's the quality of individuals. When you let them, the very best mechanisms get out of people's way and allow them to do that work. My advice is, get a dollop of common sense. Go and review what your grandparents told you, because it was probably right. Go and use that well-worn common sense. Do a review of where you are. Find out what's the next step, where can you get to, and then move it along. And you'll be surprised how quickly the whole thing starts to take off and how the momentum all of its very own. I once had to do a collaboration tool between two remote teams back in the day when nobody did. This was, you know, long before Teams and Zoom and all of that, right? Oh, I don't know how I was going to do it. And I thought some expensive software, but we're in the Ministry of Defence. It takes months, years to get it approved. Now I'm going to do this. And I just completely lost it. And I was going to thousands of pounds and I was worrying. And then I walked into the office and realised they'd solved it, because what they'd actually done is put a webcam at this end pointing at the whiteboard on the wall. And at the other end, somebody got a projector projecting the whiteboard on the wall at the other end. It was a £5 webcam. And why was I even trying to solve the problem?
Yeah.
What I should have done is just give the problem to the people who could come up with some ideas, and only if they got stuck should I need to solve the problem. A very wise man once said to me that, I was asking him how things were going. He said, I don't know, sir. He says, I only issue the toilet roll. I says, I leave the rest to them. John's no longer with us, but a very wise man. Because what he was really saying to me is, they're good people. They'll work this out for themselves. We don't need to baby them. We don't need to wipe their noses. What else did you think I meant? We don't need to wipe their noses. It's not a requirement. And you know what? He was absolutely right. And I was absolutely wrong. And I now look back and go, yeah, he taught me a lesson. And it's these lessons you learn. You don't always learn them from your betters either. You learn them from the guys sideways and beneath you as well. It's lessons that you learn that you then apply and then take forward. And the very best practice comes from there, from the ITSMF. Every word of ITIL comes from somebody's failure or somebody's pain. Every word of the Prince 2 manual. There's 1,000 people contribute to the Prince 2. I know some of them. And they've all screwed it up. Yeah. Every single piece of advice in there comes because somebody once screwed this up and they're sharing their experiences, which doesn't mean to say that their way is perfect. There's always your way, but at least they've given you a little bit further on. You've got a starter for 10, as they say in college ball. So you're a bit further on. You've got a chance then to start taking some of their screw-ups into account. But it's fundamental that they've already paid the ticket price. I love that it was John Allspar's point that every failure is a lesson you've already paid for. Mm-hmm. You've already paid the tuition fee. The embarrassment was the tuition fee. You've already paid for that. Now you've got to go and learn the lesson. And if you don't learn the lesson, then you pay the tuition fee for nothing.
Yeah.
And I love that as a concept. I like him anyway, but I love that as a concept, this idea of you paid your entrance fee because it's screwed up. So you've already paid that. Now go forward and learn what happened. And I think that's the right way to do it. And I think that we sometimes get too bogged down in what does book A and book B say, or what does they call it? What's these calling? These people all use this, but these people over here all use that. Like it's some cult or religion, and none of that matters. None of that matters at all, because I'll happily run an Agile PM project. And if my team says, we use Scrum, great. We'll call the development time box a Scrum, and we'll call the business ambassador a product owner, and we'll all just get on with it. Nobody dies, right? Nobody gets hurt. Nobody gets hurt. Or they say, this is part of continuous improvement. All right, okay. So we just call this an agile release train. Okay, fine. It's good for you. Good for me. We're all moving forward. We're all happy. You know, it doesn't really matter what the job title is. It doesn't really matter what the label is we give it. Are we collaborating? Are we working together? Do we have an idea of what's needed? Mm. Are we checking in often enough? As long as those good common sense things are happening, then so is everything else. So fundamentally, I'm going to tell you that the very best framework is in you, because you're going to tie this together, because you're going to make this work, you and I and everyone else. What's best is best right now. May not be the best forever, but it's the best right now. And I implicitly trust your listeners, because you are the people doing it. If you're listening to this right now, it's because you do this for a living, right? You're not, Matt, let's not flatter ourselves. No one is listening to us because they're a fan of hunky middle-aged men. Of course not, Matt. Nobody's listening for that. They're listening fundamentally because this is what they do for a living.
Yeah.
And therefore, if they do what they do for a living, then you probably know more than you think. And that's really my point to people, is have that trust and confidence. Because if you're a newbie at this, and if you're listening to this, it's perfectly fine to be early in your career. I was once. We all were, right? Okay, it was 1980 and punch paper tape was the thing. Anyway, never mind. But people were where they were. And we are as you now are now. We are where you are now. We once were you. That's fine, because everyone has to start somewhere. But your journey, you will learn. Somebody once said to me, oh, Jonathan's being a bit stroppy. He's a bit arrogant, a bit stroppy. I'm sorry. I said, don't apologize. I used to be him when I was 25.
Yeah.
I used to be him. I was that person. And I was much more arrogant and stroppy than he is. And I'm sure my elders and betters back then were equally as fed up with me. That's fine, because young men are supposed to think that they know better. Because that's what being youthful is all about, right? Is having that power and that imagination. And there's nothing wrong with that. And therefore, there's very little that'll hurt you. I've been doing this now for several years, and nobody died doing the IT. Nobody got seriously injured most of the time. Most of the time, most of us finish the day in one piece, right? And fundamentally, it can be a really bad day in the service desk, a really great day in the service desk. We generally all get to go home, and we all go and eat dinner. And that is a fundamental. You're not going to kill or harm people, generally. You're not going to do that much damage. The worst thing you might do is embarrass yourself just a little bit. But hey, most senior managers, whilst they might tick you off in public, in private go, yeah, I've done that. None of us. None of those po-faced senior managers that wagged fingers at you, Matt, they'd all made mistakes. They all had done probably what you'd done. Yeah. But they felt that they needed to do that. But deep down, it's all for show. Fundamentally, they know exactly what that feels like, because we all have. And it's having that confidence. So you're better than you are, than you think you are, fundamentally. More than you think, fundamentally. And actually, you've got more common sense than you give yourself credit for. Because those three things combined, what you know, what you can do, and your common sense, you combine those together and you can make decent choices. And you can say, well, I like using Prince 2 for waterfall tile projects, and I like using Scrum for agile type stuff, and I like doing business as usual with ITIL. Great, put them together. By the way, delete any of those and put any of their competitors in. Great, put them together. Some of them come from the same. Now, I like Axelos because a lot of it comes from the same stable, and so it's deliberately written, so all of this works. So when I say a measurable improvement as a result of an outcome seen as an improvement to one or more stakeholders, that's the definition of a benefit. And that's the same in Prince 2, in MSP, in ITIL, because they use the same terminology. So some of them do come from the same stable. It makes life a little bit easy because they have a shared glossary. But hey, that doesn't mean to say it doesn't work across an ocean or two. And if it works for you, it works for you. Thanks for having this opportunity for me to ramble on. But it is one of these things I'm very passionate about, to stop people beating themselves up because they think they're not doing it right.
Yeah.
It really does annoy me that people have angst and go, well, yeah, we tried to do ITIL, but we failed. And you didn't.
No.
You just took the things out of it you needed. And it's this not beating yourself up for not being perfect. But, oh, look, Google are fantastic. Well, I'm sure they are. They're very nice people. But I'm sure lurking in their infrastructure is probably more than one dirty secret.
So
by the way, anybody who works at Google wants to put any comments or add anything to the discussion.
Well, yes.
Picking on you, Google. Moving on, I could have inserted the name of any IT organization there. And they'd all go, of course not. Except because we all have our guilty secrets. It's not some paragon of virtue that you've got to be an Apple or you've got to be a Google, or if you're not a Microsoft, you're nobody. None of that's true. Because fundamentally, no, it's what your company has to be. It's what your organization has to be. And it's what you can make of it. And I just wish people would stop beating themselves up, stop beating up their staff, trying to get some impossible mountain. And just realize all we need is the next foothill. The mountains solve themselves. If we get to the next foothill, we can always move on from there. But the mountains sort themselves out eventually. And fundamentally, we only need to take things as far as we need to take them.
Bingo.
And I always say, okay, you've done a 2-day course and you've got a 16-page Scrum guide. Do you think that's everything? Really? There's probably a bit more to it than that.
There's a bit more.
Between you and me, and I run those courses, and even I go, there's a bit more to it than this. And I don't think anybody thinks that's true. Yet, there is this point that we believe in these magic talismans when it's unnecessary. So believe in yourself, trust yourself, make sensible decisions.
I love it. That is a great advice. Tomo, I want to thank you and congratulate you on not only staying in scope, you stayed on topic and on target the whole time, but you did a great job covering some of the massive topics that come up when we talk about these things, like zealotry, what to do with people that have blind faith, that are blind following these ideas. And you really helped people, I think, understand that everything is really a tool and you get to choose. And putting things in your toolbox doesn't mean that you have to use them only. You're not married to that tool forever. You can take out the tools that you need when you need them. And the best framework is when you have those references, you have that within you to understand, oh, in this situation, I might steal something from Agile, or in this situation, I might want to go into total quality management and understand how they're approaching this topic. So I want to thank you for taking the time to do that and do such a great job summarizing it. Tomo, how should people connect with you if they want to connect with you or learn more?
Oh, sure. I suppose probably my LinkedIn profile is the easiest way to track me down, or via the QA website here in the UK. But fundamentally, you'll see me pop up, as you and I have both done, on several bits for the DevOps Institute here, there and everywhere. Fundamentally, LinkedIn is probably the easiest way. All I like to say is that don't worry if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you want to talk this stuff. I'm a geek. I enjoy it. It doesn't really matter where I am. I've always believed that everything you share comes back to you eventually. Thank you. And so with that, I'd like to say thank you for this opportunity to connect with your audience. And for anyone who knows me already, I do apologize for you hearing this again. No, fundamentally, thank you for the opportunity. And for the great company you've been, we bump into each other on these things all the time. We bounce off each other. It's really great to meet another enthusiast. So thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you. And thanks for being on Ticket Volume, Tomo.
Been an absolute pleasure.
And for our audience, did you know that we are going to talk about this topic again later this month? Register for a live episode at ticketvolume.com and click on register. Thank you for listening. You can change and improve this podcast by DMing me or leaving a comment. And speaking of Ticket Volume, did you know that this podcast is brought to you by Invigate? Invigate is a fit-for-purpose service desk solution with integrated asset management designed to let you focus on supporting your organization without arduous implementations. In fact, IT teams from Toyota, NASA, and McDonald's use Invigate to manage requests, automate workflows, and centralize inventory data so that they can focus on delivering better service. Because good service is good business.